Philadelphia.
Okay.
On behalf of Victoria Johnson.
Good morning. I'm John Mahoney with Chase Adam Marsh.
All right, Mr. Mahoney, would you care to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
All right. You proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. I was appointed to represent Chase Adam Marsh on appeal following his conviction at a jury trial, and obviously another attorney had done that jury trial. As such, I am working with the record that I was blessed with. And my brief.
We understand how it works.
My brief is short and simple.
Johnny, let me start with your brief and ask you about something that gives me some pause. Rule 5A12 of our rules of court states that an assignment of error which merely states that the judgment or award is contrary to the law and the evidence is not sufficient. If the assignments of error are insufficient, the petition for appeal shall be dismissed. Your assignment of error is the trial court erred in denying appellant's motion on the jury verdict being inconsistent with the law and the evidence. I don't know how do we get past Rule 5A12 in this case?
I think, Judge, that we would say that the trial attorney was specific enough in his assignment.
That's not the trial attorney. That's the assignment of.
Well, in terms of the facts for the judge, at the bottom of page 432. In the appendix, he specifically says that they were contained in one cell. There was no case law argued at trial as to why the ones being in one cell would eliminate the evidence from being sufficient. I understand the court's question, but again, I have to say that I'm argument based on the record, and I can't argue what isn't in the record. I did ask for such other relief as this court may deem appropriate.
Well, I know you ultimately asked for ends of justice after, in the reply brief after the combo pointed out.
I did. Well, so. In the main brief, I didn't particularly cite the rule, but I in the narrative, I asked for such other relief as the court might deem appropriate. If ever there was a case that should be reversed and dismissed, it seems that this is it. We are talking about a conviction for abduction in which a man is sentenced to 20 years in prison for an abduction that occurs in a locked jail cell. I've essentially...
Well, you're suggesting that it's as a matter of legal impossibility for someone who's incarcerated to ever be abducted?
I would suggest that if they're in a locked jail cell, I can imagine many ways that somebody could be abducted within a prison system if the cells were open and they were out and about. But here we're talking locked in the cell. There is no place to go.
The detention involved in this case came as a result of the acts of the Commonwealth of Virginia, not of the defendant. The detention was
absolutely, sir. So, and not only that, there was no way for the defendant to escape after committing the crime. So he commits two.
You're not suggesting the sheriff here is a principal in the second degree or anything like that.
I think the court did that to some degree.
Does the record show the size of that jail cell?
I don't believe it does. I will tell the court it's a three-man cell. I've not been in that particular cell. I've been in other cells, just visiting.
Detention need only be slight, right?
That's exactly right.
So there are scenarios by which somebody within a jail cell could be.
I'm having a hard time seeing that scenario, and the Commonwealth paints one, standing by the window and being afraid to push a button. Had Mr. Marsh bound and gagged the victim to prevent him from yelling? Maybe then. But, you know, once the forcible sodomy is over with, my client steps away. Under the Brown case, it talks about the need to be something, however slight. And there's some level of asportation in the whole series of cases that involve abduction. There is no asportation in the mark.
So your argument essentially only is directed at the abduction charge, not the other convictions here.
That's correct, Judge. I think, you know, I'm a realist, and in a light most favorable to the prevailing party below, I'd be wasting the court's time arguing those. My client might not like it, but the reality is there was evidence there. I think that as a matter of law, when you look at Brown, there's no abduction. It's just not possible in the present case. I mean, if ever there was a situation where we can have forcible sodomy without abduction, it certainly seems to me it's got to be in a locked jail cell. And if the Brown case is to mean anything, it has to mean something in the Marsh case.
It seems to me, you make a good point, but it seems to me the issue really, in terms of whether the degree of force is incidental versus separate, where we have drawn the distinction, it's usually with aspiration, in other words, movement of the victim from point A to point B, no matter really how far. I can't remember the name of the case off the top of my head. I think it might be Brown, but I wouldn't swear to that. Where a guy walks into a fast food restaurant to rob it, makes all the employees stand over on one side of the room, and we held that was enough force, separate and apart from what was necessary to effectuate the robbery, to justify the separate conviction for abduction. Here it seems, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, we've got the victim in this case saying that he was basically shoved from, I guess, the area around his bunk to some other part of the cell. The record isn't clear about how far that was, but I think we're talking feet, not much more than that. But the question is whether that would be enough to justify a separate analysis of the crime, as opposed to simply what was necessary to effectuate the forcible sodomy.
Given the nature of forcible sodomy, there has to be some measure of force to accomplish it.
Well, clearly just holding the individual, I think we've a pretty clear case law that if the extent of the detention is to, by the use of force, hold an individual in place while you commit the act of forcible sodomy or rape or whatever the crime might be, that clearly is incidental. But where it's not absolutely necessary to effectuate the crime, we've got a different kettle of fish.
I guess I'm having a hard time visualizing the court's hypothetical, and I think what the court is suggesting is that if a victim is standing here,
let's assume a hypothetical where a home invader goes into a home at night, you know, into a woman's bedroom. She's standing near her dresser, and he grabs her and drags her 3 feet away to the bed, throws her on the bed, and rapes her. It seems to me, under our jurisprudence, that would be two separate crimes, abduction and rape. Whereas if she was already in bed and he simply, you know, held her to the bed and effectuated the rape, we would have the sort of merger of the two. And the question is, which do we have here?
I guess I think if I were arguing that case, I'd be arguing that there were separate facts and there was no abduction, depending upon other circumstances that in the hypothetical we don't have. In the hypothetical, though, there was presumably a door that the woman could have left from. We don't have that.
Well, here's there's a button that could have been pressed.
And he doesn't press it, but he's not prevented by the defendant from pressing that button. He testifies that he felt intimidated, but there's no evidence, I think, that the defendant said, "Don't touch that," and threw him away. What the Commonwealth is relying on the abduction for, at least in part with Judge Humphrey's hypothetical, is the movement from this point to perhaps that table to accomplish the forcible sodomy.
Right. Judge Humphrey's position about moving the victim from one end of the room to the bed.
And I would argue that when that movement is part and parcel of the sexual assault, then that's not a separate crime. If a culprit commits a sexual assault at that table and then prevents that victim from walking down that path and out the door, then clearly that's an abduction. If a culprit commits a sexual assault on that table by moving the person perhaps to that table to commit the assault and then allows the person to leave, no abduction would be my argument. And here...
You're into your rebuttal time. You can keep on going if you want, but I just want to alert you to that.
I would just say, back to the preservation of the issue, there was not great legal argument, but the specificity of locked in a single cell was there, and while I didn't ask under 5A18, I did, in the narrative, ask for such other relief as the court may deem appropriate. Thank you.
Mrs. Duffield?
May it please the court, good morning. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. And a detention occurred, and it was not incidental to the forcible sodomy. A detention may occur in a locked cell. A detention occurs when an individual is deprived of his personal liberty by force, intimidation, and that is certainly...
How much personal liberty does one have in a jail cell?
Your Honor, I would say that this particular victim was not able to leave his bunk. He was trapped. The defendant was within several feet of him. For the multiple minutes that the defendant stood over the victim, rubbed his genitals in his face, threatened him, told him, "You will perform oral sodomy on me," and raised his fist at the victim.
See, I don't think we're quarreling about whether there's evidence of force, threat, or intimidation.
Absolutely.
Clearly there was. I think what we're discussing and struggling with is whether there is separate force, threat, or intimidation, separate and apart from what was necessary to effectuate the sodomy.
Of course.
And, you know, and it seems to me, well, all we've got, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but all we've got is the statement that he was thrown, I guess, from the bunk area to some other part of the cell before he was actually sodomized. Is that
but an abduction need not be an aspiration. It may merely be a detention.
And no, you're absolutely correct, but the question is whether it's separate and apart from whatever, you know. It seems to me the Commonwealth's argument is pretty weak if you're talking about detention, because clearly you have to be detained in order to effectuate a forcible sodomy. And the question is whether it's enough, whether it's incidental detention or whether it's separate detention, I guess.
Of course, Your Honor. I think that the duration, if you look at the Lawler factors or the factors articulated in Lawler and a number of other statutes, when you consider the duration that the defendant forced the victim to remain seated on the bed, the fact that the victim was saying, "Leave me alone," prior to the anal sodomy, the fact that the defendant
basically... Counsel, isn't that all incidental to the to the sex crimes? Doesn't all of that point to the actual sex crimes involved as opposed to an abduction? Or
when you, I think that the duration of the detention and the forcing of the victim to remain in his bunk is greater than the actual act of forcible sodomy.
Now, so is there case law that supports that principle?
I would say that this is different than Hoyt, which was cited on brief, that had to do with a robbery, where the defendant in Hoyt forced the cashier to merely move across the store. It was 10 feet. It lasted merely moments. And then he had him open up the register and give him the money. That's not what happened here. We have an interaction between the victim and the defendant that lasted at least 10 minutes based on both the testimony of the victim and his statements to Nurse Shortall.
Of that time was taken up by the actual sexual assault?
I believe, Your Honor, that there were statements that we argued for 5 to 10 minutes before the original sexual assault occurred, being the oral sodomy. The oral sodomy lasted approximately 5 minutes. And then there was additional argument about whether or not there was going to be anal sodomy and whether or not the victim would allow the defendant to commit anal sodomy on him. And during that time, the defendant is standing over the victim, getting angrier and angrier, yelling at him, and he's standing in such a way that the victim cannot move. He can't. He feels that perhaps he could have maneuvered around, but if you have to maneuver around someone, necessarily your passage is blocked. And there isn't, unfortunately, as the court pointed out, very far for him to go. And if he was to exercise his personal liberty to remove himself from within a foot of the defendant, he was essentially trapped. So certainly the defendant prevented the victim from exercising his personal liberty to move around the bunk freely, the cell freely.
If we agree with you that there was sufficient detention in this case, and then in a subsequent case we have to apply this ruling in the context of a woman being sexually assaulted in her bedroom, where the only evidence is the woman was forced to remain on the bed during the sexual assault, would we then be required to affirm that kind of abduction also?
I think that based on the circumstances that you suggest, Your Honor, it is distinguishable, because in that case it sounds like the time that the victim was detained was coexisted exactly with the assault on the woman. In this case, you have a victim who's saying, leave me alone, and is stuck in place for at least 10 minutes before the original sodomy and prior to the second sodomy as well.
So it's that if there, your argument would be that if a victim and a defendant struggled for a few minutes prior to the actual sexual assault, that period of struggling would constitute the detention for purposes of abduction.
And I think that in this case, there's more than just a few minutes. It's 5 to 10. This encounter the evidence shows lasted for a while. And when you look at the cases where they found that the detention was incidental to the other offense, those were cases where they discussed the detention or asportation as being mere moments or moments. And this is, 10 minutes is not moments. This is not him walking across.
Well, the slippery slope here, is, I think that Petty's sort of alluding to, is where are you going to draw the line? In a typical, at least in my experience, in a lot of rape cases or sexual assault cases of one sort or another, you have a degree of force being applied for a measurable amount of time prior to the actual act of whether it's sex or some other type of sexual battery of some sort. And whether it's measured in moments or minutes or tens of minutes, I mean, where are we supposed to draw the line and say, okay, at this point you cross over and it's no longer incidental?
Well, I think you also have to consider the factor that the victim in this case was afraid to call out because he was stuck in the cell and he didn't know how long it was going to take someone to get to him. So
why is that any different from the woman that's alone in her apartment and nobody will come to help?
I think in this case the defendant was attempting to, for minutes, force the victim to willingly engage in this behavior. That's not necessarily the case in the scenario that you're suggesting. And when I say willingly, I mean under duress.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, it's not our place to you know, advise the Commonwealth about such things. But you know, there are a lot of serious charges here. It seems to be in the great scheme of things. This abduction is sort of, I'm not sure that, given the concession your opponent made, especially, that this is a battle that, you know, we want to make a lot of law on, because I think, as we're all sort of alluding to here, there are some problematic issues here, depending on how we frame this thing. I'm just making that observation. And, I mean, I think we're looking for help from the parties here in order to avoid making some bad law.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I think that in this case, the defendant's actions decreased the likelihood that the victim was going to call out, decreased the likelihood that he was going to be detected in the course of this forcible sodomy. I think that he used violence. These are behaviors that we ought to criminalize.
But all of those ought to be punished in the context of the sexual assault. And that's what I think Judge Humphreys has mentioned. That's what certainly concerns me. I mean, you probably weren't here earlier. We had a writ case where a person was charged with attempted sexual assault and abduction with intent to defile. And, of course, the attempted assault only carried, I think, one to 10 or 2 to 10. And, you know, you're letting the Commonwealth proceed with a 20 to life offense every time that there's any kind of sexual assault and any kind of detention at all.
Your Honor, I think in this case the defendant certainly behaved criminally when he, for 10 minutes, refused to allow the victim to leave his bunk.
I mean, the jury wasn't too sympathetic on the underlying sexual assault.
Absolutely.
I think they would have given the minimum on that. Is that am I correct on that?
I think
they might have. So you end up with a 20-year sentence for what appears to be the lesser of the two offenses when you've got the consummated sexual assault.
Your Honor, I think in this case, the behavior of the defendant was clearly criminal.
Probably we're disputing that. The issue is whether there's been a merger, and I mean, in the abstract, I think we could all condemn what happened here, every aspect of it. That's not what we're debating. What we're debating is how we frame a rule of law that guides trial courts and prosecutors and others in how to apply these things to day-to-day situations without unintended consequences.
Your Honor, I think that the court can apply the factors articulated in Wiggins, the duration of the detention. We have a length of detention that lasted considerably, that was beyond the amount of time it took to consummate both of the sodomies. The court appears disgracing me, but I do not think that the detention occurred in the commission of the forcible sodomy. I think that he forced the victim to stay
on his
bunk.
Counsel, let me ask you, tell us a little bit about the 5A12 issue.
Gladly, Your Honor. This court ruled in Callaway that 5A:12 only applies to petitions of appeal. However, 5A:20 does apply to briefs. And pursuant to Rule 5A:26, this court can dismiss an appeal that fails to can dismiss an appeal when a brief fails to comply with the rules.
Did the Commonwealth object to the phrasing of the assignment of error in its brief in opposition?
It did not, Your Honor. However,
didn't we say that unless the Commonwealth objects, then we're going to apply the looser standard of 5A?
Your Honor, I'd suggest that in the footnote 3 to in Callaway, the court said that the court may, in its discretion, apply 5A:26 when a brief does not comply with Rule 5A:20.
Of course, your better argument is to 5A:18.
And I'm happy to turn to that, Your Honor, if you prefer. In this case, the defendant's argument all along was that the sexual actions were consensual. That was the context of the argument both during the motion to strike during the motion to set aside the verdict, at the end of the guilt phase and at the end of the sentencing phase. While the defendant said both men were contained in one cell, there was certainly no signs of any significant force whatsoever. I think that you have to consider that in the context of he was arguing that the sex was consensual. There was never any articulation of the fact that the detention was incidental to the forcible sodomy that occurred. Given this failure to put his finger on the argument that the detention was allegedly incidental to the forcible sodomy, he failed to point out to the court, and failed to give the court the opportunity to rule on this issue.
Let me stop you, Mr. Delphi, and make sure I understand your argument. The best it gets for the defendant, and I'm looking, I guess, at page 422 of the joint appendix, is not until sentencing when the argument is ever really articulated in any sort of detail. And the trial counsel at that point said, and I'll parse it because it's a long paragraph, but the first thing he says is, I don't think that the evidence in this case rose to the quality necessary to convince or that the law requires to convict the defendant of abduction. Both men were contained in one cell. It goes on, and then at the end it says, so I don't see there is force necessary here in this particular case to support that conviction. Do I understand correctly that the Commonwealth's position is that that is not enough to establish for the purposes of the trial court to rule on an incidental force argument?
That's correct, Your Honor. And if there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the brief stated on brief and hear an argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you. I think I heard Your Honor say page 422.
Yes, that's correct.
I'm looking at...
I'm sorry, 430.
Okay, 432.
432-33, yeah.
Okay, the next page. All right. Yeah. And down there at the bottom, both men were contained in one cell. Certainly there's no sign of any significant force whatsoever. The standard the Commonwealth seeks this court to set today really is that...
Your argument is essentially that's close enough
for... The trial attorney has to get it perfect.
But that's sentencing.
But it gives the judge the opportunity to... revisit before there's an appeal.
Well, at a time after the trial's over and done.
After the trial's over. Now, he did make a motion to strike as contrary to the law and evidence, and that was...
Which, again, you pointed out is insufficient.
It would have been nice if he said they were locked in one cell at...
Yeah,
that motion to strike.
We appreciate what you're trying to do here. You were not trial counsel. You're stuck with this record.
We get that. And I appreciate the courts calling attention to the fact that sometimes bad cases can make bad law, because I sat many an hour in my office wondering, what am I going to do with this? The amount of force over a 10-minute period, I asked the court to take into consideration that there were multiple convictions of forcible sodomy. So it had to take some time. The second part of this reasoning for the Commonwealth is that he was talking to the man, trying to get him to do it voluntarily, and that's an abduction. Under the Commonwealth's theory of this case, anytime an inmate locked in his cell were to have a conversation with his cellmate that the cellmate didn't like, somehow you could pull an abduction out of that. Judge Petty hit the nail on the head when he talked about this defendant being convicted of something that far exceeds the punishment for what really is the nasty offense.
Well, I suspect that if this had just been submitted on the sodomy, forcible sodomy charge, the jury probably would have given him the entire time on the sodomy.
That's too much conjecture, and I wouldn't want the court to...
We won't do that.
Okay, thank you. I'll take your word on that one, sir. My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Mahoney. We'll come down to Greek Council and take a...